Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. While globalization has lifted millions from poverty, the forces that drove it have largely left the middle class behind. There's a growing sense that the social contract is broken. This week is the third in our three-part series on rebuilding the social contract. We take three different perspectives, that of the people, that of the business world, and that of government. On our final episode of our series, we'll be asking what people expect of their governments and how governments can fulfill those expectations. Joining us is Jason Furman. He's professor of the practice of economic policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's joined by Gillian Tett, U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
Jason Furman and Gillian Tett, welcome. Since the days of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, but certainly even before that, there were prominent public voices telling citizens around the world that the government wasn't going to come save you, wasn't going to be an answer to your problems. Now people across the world are wondering whether an explicit or implied social contract is broken and what responsibility, if any, government has for restoring it. So let's begin there. What are, if you had to give me a thumbnail, Jason Furman, what are the government's obligations?
I think at a very minimum, people broadly agree with the idea of equality of opportunity. And in a country that's highly unequal, that doesn't have a lot of institutions like paying for preschool for everyone, you can't argue with a straight face that the United States lives up to anything resembling the ideal of inequality of opportunity. I think that's a minimum part of a social compact. I think a broader part is that everyone can contribute, everyone can be connected to society. And I think for many people, that takes the form of being able to work and being able to be paid a decent amount as a result of that work.
So just part of the deal you make with a wider society is that you should be able to support yourself?
I think it's not just the amount of money you have at the end of the year. It's also, do you have dignity? Do you have meaning? Do you have purpose? There's a lot of ways to get all of that, but the surest, most reproducible way that we know is to be in the workforce, to have a job, and to connect to other people and contribute in that manner.
Gillian Tett, does government have a role to be a guarantor of any of the things that Jason Furman just mentioned?
Well, I'd go back a bit and say that what the role of the government is to really provide social cohesion and to provide, if you like, a flag, quite literally sometimes, but also figuratively, around which society can kind of coalesce and agree that, yes, we're part of one country, we're going to try and work together as one unit and basically take the steps that are needed to make that happen. Now, in some European countries, that means essentially the government plays a big role in the economy and has a redistributive effect to create that kind of social cohesion and is quite intrusive. America has traditionally tried to see that the social cohesion is both created by peer-to-peer relationships, but also institutions, and the government has traditionally had a less dominant role. But the type of thing that Jason's talking about trying to ensure that there is a legal and social and economic framework to give people dignity, to ensure that they contribute to society, to ensure that they are kept alive and leading a dignified life, or able to do so by earning money. And above all else, to ensure that the rules are sufficiently transparent, open, and fairly agreed that everyone feels that they want to buy into them. That's kind of what a government should do if you take the wider view from 30,000 feet.
At the same time as more governments are saying that that's what they want to do, after a long period where it was assumed the government was not your friend in a lot of places, and if there was a knock on the door, you were scared. There's a widespread feeling that government is letting people down, breaking its promises. Have you seen this as widespread as it is now, Gillian Tett?
Well, the feeling of being frustrated with government is certainly very high. And if you look at things like the Edelman survey or Pew surveys, they show that Americans have almost no trust or faith in Congress. In fact, the level of trust is, I think, below plumbers, somewhere around the level of trust in cockroaches. And the level of trust in other government agencies is also very low. And it's really declined dramatically since World War II. But there are two important caveats about that. One is that if you ask Americans what they trust at a local level, there's often much higher level of trust in local aspects of government. And secondly, trust in almost all institutions has declined quite sharply in recent decades. That doesn't mean trust overall has declined. Oddly enough, or rather strikingly, trust in people's peer group has remained very high. And people now are more likely to trust a category known as a person like me than a government official these days. And they're more likely to trust a company employee than the CEO. So there's been a kind of reordering of patterns of trust. But it's certainly a very tough time for a government to command much respect, not least because their resources are being increasingly squeezed.
Jason Furman, justifiably so?
I think the issue is not that the government has gotten a lot worse, but that our economic challenges have gotten a lot harder and the government hasn't risen to the task. There's been a big increase in inequality, a big increase in joblessness, especially for American men, but recently also for American women. And we went through a decade ago a massive economic recession. So all of those were, you know, not necessarily caused by the government, although the government played some role in some of those. But in every one of those cases, the government could and should have done more to respond to them, to offset some of that increase in inequality, to help people find employment, and to rebound out of the recession more quickly. And I think, you know, some combination of, you know, all of those and more are one of the reasons why, you know, people are looking at outcomes, seeing those outcomes aren't what they would like to see, and, you know, somewhat naturally and reasonably feeling less trustful as a result.
What's fascinating for me in what you just said, I've been doing interviews on this topic for 25 years, or the last 25 years, and I've seen in people, not only in the United States, but around the world, a greater feeling that they trust me. I can handle this. I'm an adult. I'm in charge of my life. I should be in charge of my life. Certainly in the Western democracies, a feeling that the state had gotten too big and the nanny state and looking over my shoulder and all that, until something goes really wrong. Too many messed up mortgages, rivers that are catching on fire, air that's polluted, skyrocketing home prices at a time of stagnant wages. Then people flip on their heels, pivot, turn to the government and say, what are you going to do about this? You should be protecting me. So you're a rugged individual, the captain of your ship, at the wheel, until something goes wrong. And then you say, hey, it's time to save me, to bail me out. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair description. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, natural disasters are a great example. We all come together and want to do something. Fortunately, don't come together quite as much for the Americans in Puerto Rico, but that is in some ways an exception that proves the rule more generally. And you know, you could say, you know, you chose to live there and you can rebuild and you can bear the cost. But I think we do believe in social and sharing risks. We do believe in everyone having a fair shot. We do believe in opportunity, a whole set of things. We don't believe in guaranteeing people a particular result at the end of the day. But, even there, it's not like anyone would support people starving in the street either. So in some sense, we do implicitly have some view, at least out of a range of results, that to us are unacceptable.
I mean, if I can jump in here, I'll say there's something else which a government does, which is to try to unify a potentially fractured society. And that last point's become increasingly important because when the internet was being developed and when social media platforms were being developed, there was this very utopian ideal in Silicon Valley that these platforms would bring everyone together, and the type of tribalism and fragmentation we see all in the real world would evaporate online. Well, of course, we now know that quite the opposite has happened, and that social media platforms have actually intensified fragmentation. And that's very dangerous, because if you couple with that kind of fragmentation online with the fact that people are increasingly trusting their peer group more than they're trusting governments, what you're creating is a potential for lots of echo chambers where people get their news or information or ideas from their Facebook friends or their Twitter followers or Twitter people they follow on Twitter, their little groups, which don't necessarily interact with each other. And so in some ways, the role of government today is to make sure that there is something overarching which unites us even at this time of tremendous fragmentation.
But, I think you're totally right about that core idea of the government is helping define who a people are. But one of the embedded promises of that digital Brave New World was that it would transcend borders, that place would mean less, that the fact that you were a citizen of one country or another would mean less in this world where we rose up to meet each other as individuals. Do we still want to be British, American, Uruguayan, Chilean?
Well, identity matters enormously. But the difference for today's world, particularly in cyberspace, is that in previous generations, identity was something that was just given to you. You didn't have much choice about what your identity was because it was defined by place and by family and by job, which is often just given to you as well. Today's world is all about customization, in that people get to choose, what kind of coffee they're going to have, what's going to be on their music playlist, and what their identity is going to be, what their news sources are. And they can do that particularly easy in cyberspace, where you can literally create your identity as you want. So perversely, a tool like the internet, which was supposed to eradicate the idea of, being a nation or a subgroup or a tribe, a place where actually the founders of Twitter created that little blue symbol, a little of a bird, because they wanted people to, quote, flock together online. It's actually ended up being a place where people fly apart because they're free to choose their identities, and actually the symbols they use for those identities matter more and more. So, when it comes to nations, national symbols matter, ethnic symbols matter. Every subgroups or tribal group type of symbols today in the modern world matters enormously.
I agree with everything Gillian said. I would add that a lot of people thought place wasn't going to matter in a world where you could telecommute to your job. Why would you need to live there? But it turns out economically, place matters even more than it used to. Being in, the major cities, bouncing ideas off of the really rich and dense networks you have there leads to even, better paid jobs than the one you have elsewhere. And those cities are pulling away economically. At the same time, you're actually seeing people move less than they used to between different places. There was a lot more geographic mobility 50 years ago than there is now. And the final thing is, immigration, places with lots of immigrants tend to be very tolerant of immigrants. There's not a lot of, anti-immigrant voting taking place in Los Angeles. Places that are just starting to get them and are seeing a faster growth of immigrants and aren't as used to them are where you see some of that greater hostility, greater degrees of nativism. So it's at the places where our society is changing the fastest, not has already changed, that you see some of these tensions and ruptures opening.
Who do they want to fix that? They want the government to protect them from this being swamped, from this involuntary change of the local culture, in this sense that they were being outnumbered, that they don't hear their language on the street. These kinds of things fueled the Brexit vote. They fueled the Trump campaign. They the resort to government to help me continue to be the kind of member of my nation that I've always wanted to be has been one of the most salient calls on government to do something. Right? We may not have that much faith that the government can change the economy or get me my job back, but they can keep those people from coming in.
Well, maybe a better way of looking at it, if you like, is to think of a soccer match. Because people are free to play soccer, and at the end of the day, you have to play soccer with each other to actually get a game. But you do need somebody to decide where the pitch has been, or if there's a pitch already, to make sure that there's some commonly agreed rules for where the edge of the pitch is and where the goal is, and some commonly agreed rules that are basically acceptable to everyone and which are enforced. And in some ways, that's what the government needs to do in a broader level today, which is to ensure that there is a society which everyone vaguely buys into to a degree, feels that is fair in some senses, and has a set of mutually agreed rules which provide a sense of order.
But has the government, Gillian Tett, been left after this period of, let's say, declining faith in the authority of the government, the authority with which it speaks? Has it been left somewhat eroded, both in its real ability to respond to challenges and its perceived ability to respond to challenges, which sometimes ends up being the same thing?
Well, the problem, as Jason says, is that expectations are erratically sky high. Sometimes people expect nothing, but then they suddenly expect everything. And meanwhile, the resources of the government are not that great. And people are very torn because, again, of this shifting pattern of trust. They like the idea of being self-reliant, and they like the idea on a day-to-day basis of trusting their peer group, particularly through intermediated through technology. I mean, people, you know, probably trust their Uber drivers more than they trust Congress today, to put it crudely. And yet, there's still this recognition that there is nothing else that's going to unite the nation at the moment quite so effectively as a government or even define the nation.
There's a widespread conviction, and you've reported on it, that things are headed in the wrong direction, that old right track, wrong track question that public opinion researchers ask, and as importantly, I think, a declining faith that their own children will live better lives. These would appear to be powerful drivers of this disenchantment that we've been talking about. Fair?
I think it is, and there's a problem, which is that the more concerned you are about social problems, the more you want something to change. But at the same time, it erodes the trust that we've been talking about in this conversation. And when your trust goes down, you actually don't trust the government to do anything about the problem that you identify. And so it can lead to a certain, you know, flailing of, you know, concern about these problems, but not really, you know, having enough trust in anyone to do anything about the problems. And I think that can lead to, you know, reinforce some of the other dynamics we've been talking about of, you know, different groups and different groups' identities, where people feel more in common with the people around them. They're more willing to do something. That helps everyone. When people think the people around them are different from a different group, that generosity can diminish quite substantially. And so, you know, as problems go up, trust goes down. As trust goes down, you want the government to do less. As you want the government to do less, it reinforces these divisions. These divisions themselves can compound it. So in some ways, I think the cycle doesn't have some automatic self-equilibrating mechanism that as the problem gets bigger, it leads to a bigger solution. That doesn't necessarily happen at all.
Well, Jillian, if we were to talk about solutions, and with this widely held lack of trust, lack of deference, lack of faith that the government is still a potent player in your life, is the answer different in a new democracy, in a post-Berlin Wall democracy, a place where there isn't long experience of elected government, as compared to some place that's been choosing its leaders for a good long time? Are the expectations different among the people themselves? Is there a sort of resignation in a Romania or a Bulgaria versus this sort of disenchantment that you see in Western countries?
Well, one solution is to look at countries where government appears to be working a bit better, or at least is slightly better trusted or less despised. And I sometimes like to think about what I call the three S's, which is Singapore, Switzerland, and Sweden. Singapore is striking because you have a geographically small place where the government has done an extraordinarily good job in creating a sort of joined up set of policies. And it does that partly because being a government official is highly respected. They're paid a lot of money and they are encouraged to think long term. Most people wouldn't like the authoritarian aspect of the government that goes along with that, but they are impressive in terms of their skill sets. Switzerland's fascinating because it takes a rather different tack. It's very, very decentralized. And the local cantons, the local regional governments, have a lot of power, tax-raising power. And the local population can see very clearly how they are inputting to local decisions and where their money is being spent. And it's a pretty effective structure. So one lesson there is to say, actually, the decentralized federal model that America has, which frankly is very similar to Switzerland, could be, again, a very good way to think about things. And the last option is Sweden, where essentially you have got a strong sense of social compact, at least up until now, and a feeling that actually everyone should be in things together. And the Swedish government is by no means perfect. It's got plenty of bureaucratic flaws, but it is more highly respected, and it does manage to really contribute to a sense of social cohesion in Sweden in a way that, again, I think America could potentially learn from.
There's a nice contrast there, too, because Singapore is a highly multi-ethnic state, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multilingual, and still manages to trundle on in a fairly efficient way. Switzerland is multilingual, but not very racially diverse. And Sweden, periodically, like some of the Nordic countries, has wobbled a little when faced with the challenges of modern pluralism in a racial, ethnic, or linguistic sense. But they all work in their own ways.
They all work in their own ways. And this shows there's no one way to do it. I mean, Singapore, for example, has taken measures that most Americans would be horrified by, which is it has very tight controls on residential housing, and it actually intervenes in the so-called private markets, local housing markets, to prevent ghettos emerging of just Malays or just Singapore Chinese and things. And I don't think most Americans would really accept that in quite that way. They might, in America, you might have rules saying that you can't exclude people from certain areas, say through mortgage controls. But you know, the American government's never tried to force people to live in certain areas to break down inter-ethnic tensions. But I mean, I think America needs to look at all three of those S's and say, what is it about Switzerland, Singapore, and Sweden that works? What can we learn from? Personally, I feel very strongly that Switzerland is the most encouraging model for America because America does have a federal structure. And I often joke that if you want to feel depressed about the government, go to Washington and look at the federal structures. If you want to feel really optimistic, look at the thousands of tiny little test tube experiments happening with local government across America, which are able to happen because of the federal structure. Some are terrible, but sometimes on the local level, there are really inspiring examples of bipartisan, sensible, practical action that frankly could be a model for everyone.
What are some of the solutions to what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes plus as plaguing us?
I think getting the policies right is part of the answer to your question. And to get those policies right, the evidence on investing in children, something like every child should have a fair shot. That may mean preschool, that may mean nutritional assistance, that may mean housing vouchers, that may just mean, you know, more cash for families with children to figure out what they want to. Then enabling people to have a launch into their professional life by making college available to everyone. And the way I would do that is a combination of free community college and for everyone else. If you can pay back the cost of your college, that's great. And if you can't, that cost would be forgiven so that no one has to default on a loan. And then as you go out into your professional life, we need to do more to support people at work, whether that's creating demand for more types of jobs in areas like infrastructure, making workplaces more flexible so that people, men and especially women, can work and balance that with their families. And you know, while we would want to fight for every single job we have, recognize at the end of the day, some of those jobs aren't going to pay as much as we'd like. Some of those jobs will even go away when we don't like, and provide people effectively with insurance against that, both rewarding work and helping people get back on their feet, you know, if they lose their job.
People realize that something needs to be done to create a sense of an umpire having a set of rules which are being enforced and at least providing a pitch for everyone to play on, to go back to the soccer analogy.
Jason Furman, a lot of your suggestions were really attractive, but what they have in common is that they would take time to work. Do our leaders have time? Is the public in any mood in the various places in the world where trust has broken down to give them that time for some of these more systemic approaches to work?
Yeah, I mean, there's some things that could affect people right away: a higher minimum wage, expanded tax credits for people that work. Those would get people money right away. But the truth is, a lot of the most important problems in our society will take time to address and solve. I think there are a lot of people that understand that what matters is their children. Are their children going to be able to do better than them and succeed and thrive? And understand that a certain amount of patience and future orientation is the answer to that, and are realistic about our ability to wave a wand and turn things around. But I think, you know, I think there is a combination of things that act right away and explanations for why we need to invest in the future that can make and should make a compelling package.
So if one of the 20-plus presidential candidates, so declared, in the United States, went to the people and said, you know, we didn't get here overnight, and it's going to take us some time, is the public ready to give them that time, Jason Furman?
I wouldn't give anyone lots of time to act. You know, act right away. Some of that action is going to matter right away, but, you know, some of it inevitably is going to take time. So I think if you are acting, if you're fighting for people, if you're doing everything you can to create better jobs and prepare people for those jobs, my hope would be that people could see that, understand it, and reward it. But to do all of that requires trust. You know, if you're saying we're going to do something today that's going to matter a few years from now, you need a certain amount of trust to build that gap. And you know, I think the restoration of trust may not be in those policies themselves, but how we, you know, who the messenger for those policies is and how they're communicated and talked about.
Gillian Tett, there have been plenty of elections lately. In Ukraine, they've elected a former, a comedian who has played a Ukrainian president on television in a comedy. They've elected comedians to prominent positions of public trust in Italy, and elected Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party in Hungary. If you are in a place where democracy is looking a little wobbly, What are some of the specific things you can do to strengthen the idea that the people rule, but at the same time, government needs to have some juice and some authority at the same time?
Well, I'd say the first step is to think local, because as I said before, I think that local government is probably more effective than federal government in terms of getting local, you know, people's buy-in and a sense of control and agency of their life. And part of the problem in America today is, to put it crudely, the country's just too darn big to have a real sense of cohesion and effectiveness often at the federal level. So, you know, that's one very important point. Second point is to ensure that the system of taxation is seen as moderately transparent and fair and gets everyone to feel some sense of buy-in into the system. Make sure that the spending is transparent. Make sure there's a real sense of accountability. That's very important indeed. And there are a lot of digital tools that you can use today to get that kind of peer-to-peer communication and transparency, which can be used to try and create more sense of cohesion potentially. And last but not least, I think it's important to make sure you have civil servants who are actually motivated. Now, I'm talking right now about the government civil service, not the elected politicians. When it comes to the elected politicians, that's another problem altogether. And part of the problem with the elected politicians is simply the permanent electoral campaign in America, because the two-year cycle means that somebody somewhere is always campaigning. And that turns the government into a campaigning machine, not a governing machine.
We've been hearing from Gillian Tett of the Financial Times and Jason Furman of the Kennedy School about the role of governments in rebuilding the social contract. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation, moderated by Ray Suarez. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Our program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Jason Furman. He's professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and he's in conversation with Gillian Tett, U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program again or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
Let's talk more about taxation. What do you see as the problems that need to be addressed with any fix that would enhance this lost trust, this lost cohesion that we've been talking about?
Well, a good place to start would be to making sure that both the rich and the poor pay tax, and do so in a way that's simple, transparent, and relatively fair. And the current American tax code, which essentially lets billionaires and gazillionaires off the hook much of the time, and penalizes small people. The fact that the IRS has been gutted and tends to go after small, poorer taxpayers rather than the wealthy ones these days. The fact that many people have no idea where all that tax money is going. All of that has really badly eroded faith that tax is actually a mechanism to not just fund government efficiently, but also create that level of, you know, social buy-in that's needed.
Jason Furman, this is something that must have bedeviled you when you were on the president's economic team.
Yeah. Oh, I certainly think there's a lot of egregious loopholes. You know, we teach our students that if an activity has a positive spillover to society, it should be subsidized. You know, right now we subsidize hedge funds and private equity by taxing the people in those businesses at a lower rate. I don't think anyone thinks that those have large positive spillovers for society such that you should tax a private equity manager at a lower rate than you would tax a school teacher. So I think, like Jillian said, a lot of things in our tax code are out of whack. The problem is, even if you fix all of those things, you're not going to raise a sufficient amount of revenue to make the types of investments in education, infrastructure, opportunity, and making work pay that I think are critical. And you know, what countries around the world have done is figure out how to have a little bit of a broader-based everyone contributes and everyone gets something for their contribution. We have that here in Social Security. You pay into Social Security and you get money out of Social Security. In most other countries, you have something like that, but you also have something like a value-added tax that everyone pays into, everyone gets something out of. The problem is a chicken and egg one. If you just stand up and talk about a new tax, it'll sound like you want everyone to pay more. Can you link that to and show some direct benefit that people will get out of it, I think is the key to having you know, a system that does something that, you know, many of the other countries we've talked about do successfully, which is do a better job of ensuring that everyone can contribute to the gains and share in those gains of society.
When you're dealing with a country like the United States, where the right role and the right size and the right power of government has been a 225-year debate, and if you ask a lot of people, they think they're taxed enough already. How do you have the adult conversation? Well, we're going to borrow $1 trillion this year to pay for things that won't be paid for by taxes. How do you have the adult conversation that gets more buy-in into an idea that you've suggested that a lot of these things need more investment and need more money than they're being given at the moment? Sounds like a tough ask.
I think it is a tough ask. And sometimes I despair of our ability to have it. You know, we would not have Social Security and Medicare today if people didn't think it was worth paying in a bit more to get those. Everyone paid in. Everyone got something out of them. At several junctures after Social Security was originally created in the 1930s, we as a country said, you know what? This isn't generous enough. It's too hard to get these benefits. We don't have sufficient benefits for disability and the like. And we actually expanded Social Security benefits and agreed to pay more for it. The last time we've had any conversation like that in this country was in the 1970s. Since then, we've had multiple rounds of tax reduction. I think many of those have helped alleviate some of the economic blows that families have faced. But it's gotten to the point where it is, running the government on the type of resources we have, which is much less than almost any of the other advanced economies, much less than what we ourselves have had for most of the last 50 years. It just gets harder and harder. The budget deficit can make up for some of that difference. But ultimately, I do think people will have to choose between many of the things that are popular, like college, and whether those things are good enough that they're worth paying for.
Jillian, the Greek state was circling the drain, even as it was widely acknowledged that there was almost endemic tax avoidance. In Mexico, the common people who are largely paying their taxes, work on the assumption that the richest people in the society aren't. This would seem to be a big part of just how much faith you're ready to put in the state.
Well, the question of whether everyone is fairly paid in their taxes is absolutely crucial, and I strongly agree with you on that point, that, you know, there needs to be a sense that both rich and poor are paying in a fair way. And I think there are three tangible things that can be done to try and look at this issue. One is to put money into the IRS or whatever tax collection authority exists to give them the tools to try and impose a tax code that's fair. And that's very important because, in fact, the IRS in America has been stripped out of resources in the last few years. ProPublica has done some brilliant reporting on that in a way that's quite shocking. Secondly, they can use a lot of modern big data techniques to try and collect taxes in a fairly fair way and ensure that there isn't widespread tax evasion that in a way that benefits the rich. That's incredibly important. And thirdly, governments can do with taxes what many parents do with vegetables when they're feeding their kids, which is to slip them into everyday life in ways that people don't always notice. So just as a parent might try and get a kid to eat spinach by putting it into a sauce or a pizza, there are ways to raise more revenue by, say, looking at a fuel tax or value-added tax or things like that, which are less visible and contentious than simply jacking up income tax rates. Now, the problem with this is they also tend to be regressive in that they hit rich and poor alike, and that can often be deemed to be very unfair. Poor people are less well placed to pay, say, a fuel tax or a value-added sales tax. But I suspect that as the tax needs go up, and if there isn't a change in the attitude of the public towards paying more tax, those kinds of discrete sideways taxes will become increasingly widely discussed.
And play some role in healing the breaches in the social contract, closing some of those gaps between people's faith and fidelity, their confidence in government and government's ability to deliver on its promises?
I wouldn't go quite so far as saying that people are going to suddenly come together and sing Kumbaya and say, yes, we love the IRS. But, you know, anything which would demonstrate that rich people are paying taxes too right now would be an extremely good thing. I mean, frankly, I think there's a strong need for the, you know, White House, Washington, Congress to put money into the IRS and tell them very explicitly that their key target right now is to go after the wealthy, not the poor. Whether Donald Trump and his White House colleagues would like that tilt of the policy world, I wouldn't dare to speculate. But in my view, that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I strongly agree with more tax enforcement. And you put a dollar into the IRS and you're going to get more than $10 back in additional revenue, all of that without changing any law at all, just making people pay what it is they already owe. You do run into the challenge that for a lot of the highest income households, the problem is not that they're illegally underpaying taxes. It's that the law gives them a lot of opportunities to shield income, especially capital income, from taxes, and what they're doing to avoid taxes is 100% legal. And so if you're not changing the law, you're ending up, you know, more going after politically popular groups like small business than you are some of the most successful. But, you know, I certainly think we need to do both changing the laws and making sure we're enforcing the laws we have now, especially against the highest income households.
I agree with Jason very strongly in what he's just said there, that actually it is also about changing the law. And one of the things that's really remarkable is if you talk to some of the wealthy gazillionaires these days, they would agree that it's outrageous and crazy that, say, the tax rate on a cleaner or teacher is higher than the tax rate often than a private equity player. So there's actually pressure for change from some of the wealthy people as well, not least because they fear that this level of perceived inequity will eventually lead to pitchforks at the gate further down the road.
Is that a real danger in a lot of places? I mean, can you think of places where the system is wobbly enough that that's something you actually have to seriously think about?
I'm not quite as worried about it being a real danger, but I think a lot of people think it is, and I'd hate to discourage them from that thought because I think it goes in the right direction in terms of public policy.
I was at the so-called Milken Conference in Los Angeles recently, where you have about 4,000 to 5,000 wealthy investors and business leaders gathered together. And it was remarkable the degree of unease about the potential for a future social backlash is right now. And that might be overstating things. Maybe they're wrong. Maybe they're too fearful. But it's definitely a current which is running through the elite at the moment. And as Jason says, you know, if I was advising a government right now that wanted to push for reform, I would use that sense of unease. And to my mind, one of those powerful statements that came out of that conference was one of the wealthiest hedge fund managers saying that FDR had essentially saved his class in the early years of the 20th century by enacting measures that tried to equalize society a bit in America, i.e. he'd avoided the pitchforks by having the temerity and farsightedness to do something about it. And I think that message is definitely being pondered by many of America's elites today.
Jason, is there a virtue in setting some near-term, achievable, and obvious goals that almost act as confidence builders in a society where there's not a lot of confidence in the ability of government to get things done? One of the most popular campaign lines is that government is ineffective and can't accomplish things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Americans should get a raise right away. That's a case where you have seen a lot of action at the state level, at the local level, but that's missing out on, you know, an awful lot of Americans. And so federal action is clearly warranted. I think a tax cut for sort of low, moderate income workers, people who have the, you know, are working hard, even with a minimum wage increase, maybe aren't taking home enough pay, is another thing that we could do right away. What both of those policies leave out, though, is, you know, what you can do to speak to people, you know, in the middle. And I think the truth is it's a bit harder to just pull a lever and, you know, dramatically change life for somebody who makes $70,000 or $80,000 a year, you know, overnight. I think a lot of those do take more time and maybe need to just explain that.
Is that where the breach, where the fraying of the social contract is most apparent to you, Jillian, among those people who might be in families just below the median income in the $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 range?
I think it probably is because they regarded themselves as being middle class and felt that they were part of this middle class American dream, and that they are feeling increasingly that the dream may be slipping away.
Government, from time to time, has often waded into marketplaces, waded into the operation of certain key industries, and basically said either we're going to regulate you now, so do this, do this, do this, or we're going to intervene on the side of people who are feeling pressed and just change the rules of the game. Yet at the same time, we have become, I think it's fair to say, suspicious of government intervention in marketplaces, in putting extra market devices into the operation of certain economic operations in the society, where you just say, well, we started out to do X, and we ended up living out the law of diminishing returns, the law of unexpected consequences. It didn't work.
I think this is a good example of where the dichotomy between the market and the state may be the wrong way to think about a problem. We've had increasing numbers of parts of our economy dominated by a very small number of firms. The solution in those areas of our economy, whether it's airlines, telecom, technology, hospitals, is more competition, more markets. But we can only get that if the government helps us to bring that about, whether that's blocking mergers, engaging in more vigorous antitrust, having the type of regulations that aren't about penalizing existing companies, but helping enable new companies to enter those markets. So there's a lot of areas in our economy where we can give people more choices, more innovation, lower prices. But to get there, we need the government to do something, to help foster more competition and more of the private sector.
Can our politics, because you've heard Jillian on the operation, her view of the operation of things in Washington, can our politics get you to that result where a two-party system in a bicameral legislature with an executive branch, with a distribution of powers, can actually be potent enough to get some of these things done?
Well, I think one reason you're seeing the surge of populism is because people aren't just protesting against a specific party or specific set of policies. They're protesting against the way that the entire political structure works today. And they're disenchanted with the lack of real accountability, the lack of real voices, and the feeling that, you know, politics in some ways is broken insofar as it's supposed to be a mechanism to let the popular will express itself and shape the government and to promote long-term trade-offs and policy-making solutions.
The problem is that the solution to our problems isn't over-promising and under-delivering. And, you know, that gets back to this question of, are you doing things that help people right away or investing in a better future? And, you know, if you try to promise too much about things right away, that can get you through the next election, but it's not going to get you through many more past that and, you know, restore the type of trust and faith and social compact in a durable way that, you know, I think is very important.
I'd love to hear some more specific ideas, things that people would see, that they would feel, and that might go some distance, obviously not the whole way, toward fixing some of the problems you've been identifying during the program. Given the state of play, given where we're at in the Italys, in the Frances, in the Japans, countries with very different sets of challenges, but also a common sense that there are problems that we just can't fix anymore, that we just don't know what to do, we're out of ideas, our quiver is empty.
Well, I'd say you need to separate out the problem into two parts. Firstly, there's a question of how does the government bureaucracy work? Is it transparent? Is it accountable? Is it efficient? Everybody should read a wonderful book by Michael Lewis called The Fifth Risk, which looks at the problems inherent in government agencies being run down and becoming inefficient and the dangers that creates. And there's a lot you can do using modern technology, digital communications to make government agencies much more efficient and accountable to people. And working at the local level, I think, is absolutely crucial. Particularly at the moment when people are feeling, you know, disenchanted and frankly cut off from the control of their lives. And then secondly, we need to think about politics. How do we actually elect officials? Do we do so in a way that's actually meaningful? Do we give people more than just one choice? You know, I think increasingly the idea of just choosing between two parties every 4 years or even every 2 years is not a particularly good way for people to ascertain the will of the people and let people feel they have their voice. Are we letting candidates actually rise to prominence on the back of their ideas and their campaigning style rather than just their ability to collect the checkbook? These are all elements that are needed to try and create a much more transparent type of government in the wider sense that people feel they actually want to buy into.
I specialize in thinking about economic policies, but I agree that there's nothing more important than political reform. A lot of the economic policies I like, we won't get absent a political reform, and that a political reform that, you know, makes government more responsive. You know, the number of times I was in government and I saw something that easily would have gotten a majority of the House and the majority of the Senate, but it didn't become law because it was blocked by one party or didn't get a supermajority was, you know, to me extremely frustrating. So I think there are a lot more things that there's agreement on than, you know, what our political system is actually able to act on. So, you know, possibly even starting there might be the right place to start.
As you end this conversation, are you in a position to feel optimistic about the democracies of the world to get this right, to reinvigorate a confidence in government, to heal, to restore, to rebuild the social contract in the final analysis?
I'm not very optimistic that there will be a sense of social peace anytime soon. I do think we are at a very important, very stressful transition phase right now as we move into the digital age. But what does make me optimistic is that what digital communications have done is give a voice to everybody. And right now it's being expressed in a very incoherent way that's creating as much social fracture as it might actually ever heal. But human ingenuity is amazing, and the wisdom of crowds can often be powerful too. And so I continue to hope that even amid all these stresses and strains, the power of our smartphones, our computers, our digital networks will actually find a way to surface better ideas for how to govern ourselves in the end.
Jason Furman, same question. Do you end this program as an optimist who believes that some of the real cleavages between people and their own governments can be healed?
I'm also optimistic. It may be blindly, irrationally, temperamentally optimistic, and I can't help it. But you also look at younger people and, you know, the greater acceptance of pluralism and diversity, and then how that feeds back into support for the types of policies that are inclusive of everyone. And, you know, the fact that economic progress may not continue always at the rate we want and as shared as we want, but it does continue and it does happen. And so I think all of those factors, generational change, overall economic growth, and, you know, sort of eventually figuring out the right thing in a lot of areas will hopefully come through for us as a country and for countries around the world.
A qualified optimist. Jason Furman, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me. Great conversation.
Gillian Tett, thanks a lot. A great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a great program.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Jason Furman. He's a professor of the practice of economic policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and he's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He's joined by Gillian Tett, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. On the next World Affairs. One big issue that's in the news is Iran.
What I worry about today is that it's not aimed at a better deal. What it's aimed at is producing either the capitulation of this theocratic regime in Tehran or its implosion. Mm-hmm. And I think tactically, what, you know, you see the sort of current buildup aimed at is provoking the Iranians, and they're quite capable of taking threatening actions. As we've seen all too often in the Middle East, is escalations get very hard to manage, especially in a region with so many players and so many currents. And so I think there's a lot of risk in the situation right now. And I think it was a significant mistake to bail out of the nuclear agreement, not only because of the danger of collisions, whether they're advertent ones or inadvertent ones, because it widens the fissures between us and our closest European allies, in a sense doing Vladimir Putin's work for him. Yeah.
Bill Burns was in the room for virtually every major foreign policy decision of the past 30 years. Tune in next week to hear from the former Deputy Secretary of State, Bill Burns. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.